very much. Extremely happy to be here. Anyone I've talked to that has done the Ovale speaks very highly of it. I'm amazed to see so many people come out every Monday. You know, it's just astonishing. I'm going to read a few poems from the collection. I think, like a lot of people, I wrote a lot of poetry when I was in my teens, and it was very bad. And then I just stopped, and then about 15 years later, I came back to it. And there's one of the poems in this is kind of a poetic statement on Ars Poetica, so I'll just read that out first, and then I'll launch in. Ars Poetica, poetic art. All about the muse, I suppose. I haven't seen her in 15 years. I've grown so used to her absence, the memory more vague with every backwards glance, that I've begun to doubt I'd ever met her in the first place. Then, out of the blue, she turned up, middle-aged, lecherous, slovenly in her dress, a layer of cheap powder and a waft of gin on her breath. The grin I gave her must have revealed how far into life I waited, wondering, is this what the muse has become that I once mistook for beauty? She grinned back at me, quick as a thought. You're a muse, she winked. The first poem I wrote after the big gap was this is back in 2000. My mum was an avid bird watcher, and I was living over in England at the time. And she, it's a bit of a long story, but she became terminally ill anyway with cancer. And I knew she loved birds, and I was trying to just think of something to do, so I worked on this poem and eventually wrote it to her called Swallows. And this is the one that actually ended up, and it was the first poem I'd written in literally the first poem I'd written in 15 years, and it ended up winning the 10 Minute Naughty with Poetry Ireland just before she died, which is kind of lovely, like, you know, because it was to her. Swallows. You might know swallows have always had a long association with the flight of the soul, leaving the body, back in Greek and Roman times. Swallows. Side wings slide from the low vaults, calling, fall through the line of sight, swing wide and tight to the lawn, race their shadows. Racing an arc, a long drawn mower sweep, the live blades wheel and leap at once upwards, deep, deep in the blue air. Chatter, thrown wide over unplowed wings, they gather high and scatter in heavy reels to sow their sky notes, peals, thin chips of sound, till they halt, crest, fall again low to the ground, and reap the long hours that have grown there over the fields. The seasons turn, the dust-silted eaves fall dumb, shunned by the faints of leaving flights in shadow. They weave and scatter at nightfall, gather their numbers, and siding and sweeping the hollows, they harvest in the last sheaves of light, and then they are gone, and with them the summer. And then, funny enough, the last poem that I wrote that's in this collection about 8 years later, and it's also about a bird. And again, I was trying to just capture what a bird does in sound. We used to live in the country in County Dublin with my mum. With the whole family, like, and then we actually had a colony of pheasants that lived in the garden, believe it or not. There were seven of them. So this is called Pheasant Plucker. So I'm going to say it early before I have a few drinks and get it wrong. Pheasant Plucker. That dappled woodcairn, ducking and diving, eking and edgy, living from briars, thrusting through jagged hedges, a phallic head, red-eyed, and coarse-grained clockwork, cocky as Jagger, and just as cantankerous, would be, you would think, fair game. Such pride is proverbial. After the throat break, flight is an eruption, a bout of feathers tossed up in a burst of inadequate wings that hold the great tail, the cumbersome bustle, some 20 yards before he falls back amidst the stubble into a strut where females flock to him. It's a poem about male envy, really, isn't it? They're remarkable birds, they're just such a contradiction in a lot of ways. Okay, I was asked when I came in here, I'm really a gale go good. And I don't have very much Irish at all, I'll be honest. You're gone. But I did write one poem in Irish, which, funny enough, Roddy Gorman, you know, and Gough took up and stuck into it over in Scotland. So, this probably exhausts the full amount of my Irish. It was a very short poem. Co-Rona Trinola. Smear a shachron so colosh there one, the bonus anachan of Asmavi Quivna, nor a hosky dara garousi kind young fain falsic falro de vis. Three chesh na fragat do reaching. Hey, be a kind. Hey, be a geishach. I was nanum day. Hey, one evenus, as in stad's chin. And then Noel came to my publisher over in Kerry. He asked me to just do a version in English. And it was just a few thoughts that came to me when I was doing my PhD in Trinity. And it's actually called Trinity Colloquy, just about how we're all divided inside and we have more than one personality. As I was wandering between faculties this morning, I got a kick out of my own forgetfulness when I realised I'd been talking to myself all the while I was walking. Three questions arise out of this. Who was doing the talking? Who was listening? And in God's name, who got such a buzz out of it all? Anyway, that's my full Irish new book. Yeah, this is a very, very short poem. And this is like, my mum ended up, she was diagnosed with liver cancer and given 4 weeks to live. But she ended up kind of, she lasted 7 or 8 months because basically in her mind she'd made this deal that she was going to wait until my little brother got married and she wasn't going to go before that happened, and that wasn't going to happen for 8 months. She somehow hung on. But very often you notice when someone has, you know, a terminal diagnosis, that language suddenly shifts. You can't say things in the same way. And this is really based upon that. It's a very short little meditation on it, I suppose. It's called conditional. What about the conditional tense that we use? The if tense. Or mood, I suppose, technically. Conditional. Death stole up, wearing the mask of a surgeon. He put out our word when, saying it had grown malignant, then stitched over the incision with an ugly line of ifs. I doubt up to this point that any of us had realised how clumsy this word is, how little to be trusted. I once did a poetry course. I'm sure we've all done poetry courses at different times with Maeve McGuckie, and I was giving it. And she just asked us all to bring a poem, and I brought this particular one. It's called Shaving Mirror. And she just picked up one, Shaving Mirror. Every man has to write a poem called Shaving Mirror. I don't know how true it is, but apparently that's when we have our existential thoughts. So here's my existential thoughts. I'm looking into a mirror as I'm shaving. Shaving mirror. The illusion in its concave retina is virtual, magnified, and upright, which shows the treachery of words. Rather say the image exaggerates with the precision of satire. It's a theatre of parallax, a moving circle centred on the eye, a mercurial portrait to which time, a third-rate artist who can't leave well enough alone, returns, morning after morning, to rework line and hatching with ever coarser charcoals, until the figure is botched once and for all into caricature. There's very little that I write that's directly political in any way, shape, or form. But I will say about this one that this actually was a response in some way to 9/11. And you wouldn't know, and there's nothing in the poem to indicate it at all. It's actually, it's entitled Wasp. And in my life I've been stung twice by a wasp. Not the same wasp, a different wasp. I've twice been stung by wasps. And it's always been in September, when they're going mad and they're kind of trying to get rid of whatever sting they have. And both times it's when you've been told, if you don't touch him, he won't sting you. Okay. Anyway, so it's called Wasp. Wasp leaves its paper lantern nest, a painted samurai. September has filled it with jitters. When it crawls the globe of a pitted windfall, wings fidget, and to right it's stumbling. Its antennae are nerve ends. A humour of the grey air has maddened the venom inside its double-jointed abdomen. Black bile, yellow bile. It can sense the end. Now it turns kamikaze, launching into one last delirious flight. It is fanatic, frenetic, simply dying to fall upon the sword. Another thing I don't really write a lot of is political poetry and also love poetry. It was pointed out to me there's only one love poem in the whole thing, and funny enough, it's actually one of my favourite things in the world, my most constant steady love affair. It's all about wine. Anyway, we won't even start on how much I like wine, but anyway. This is my ode, my love poem to wine. Veiled muse, votary of all things profane, so far from vine as plain song from choir, who pressed you into this cloister of glass? Who set this seal on your rubicund singing? Let me draw out your recusant soul from the cell of its dark confinement to the burnt, the green calyx, this sanctuary lamp, and pleasures the air with decanting. What cardinal shame so confined your bloom and furled up your tenebrous petals? One by one, let my mouth open them and know again the fruit of your prodigal interior. I've read two more now. This is a kind of a companion one in a way. It's Oysters, although you never have read around the Oysters, but never mind. Still Life with Oysters is called. It's actually, I lived in Spain for a year, I lived in Venezuela for a year, and at the time I was going out with two different people, but you reach a stage where you actually think and dream in Spanish, which is lovely, so it's written in Spanish. But then, again, Noel asked me would I put it into English, so I'll just give you the English version. Still Life with Oysters. The towel is damp with struggle. Elemental steel inched inward to fret out a fulcrum. When the cuticle yields, salt water dribbles out from each nacreous interior. Then the blade's quick twist cleaves the roughshod palate into sky and reflection. We would know nothing of preliminaries. We content ourselves momentarily that the eye glut itself on such nakedness as palpitates upon the rock ice. Behind the wine's green chill, a basket of discarded plaques could masquerade as scapulae. But already we're impatient for that acute instant when all tone dissolves into salinity.
Chance of the Spanish
version.
Yeah, the
Spanish
version,
yeah.
Naturaleza muerte con ostras, la toalla se empapa de la lucha, la navaja avanzando a tientas para cruzarse un fulcro, a medida que cede la tutela, los interiores del nácar babean salmuera, una torsión brusca del cero raja pues la tosca paleta en cielo y reflejo. No tengamos nada que ver con los preliminares. Quedémonos contentos del momento que el ojo pueda acercarse de cuanto desnudas sea vergüente entre las piedras de hielo. Detrás del verde y frío del vino, una canasta de cascos descartados podría convertirse en escápulas. Mas ya estamos pendientes del instante agudo cuando cada tono se deshaga en salinidad. Yeah, Just what about change rooms, and then I'll finish off with the last one. Back in my not just my student days, I had a lot of student days. I went back to college a few times. I was addicted to it, but I also lived abroad for 10 years in a lot of different countries. And I used to have to change country or flat or room about once every year for about 12 years. And I just remember thinking how much a room actually comes to represent who you are at times, even though you don't actually choose it. It's almost like the caveman putting change himself. And this is kind of about that, how changing rooms is almost change of identity. Changing rooms. In closing space, time becomes enclosed. Half awake, you hear the flutter of wings against the bed sits economic confines. Feathers accumulate in every vertex until the air is stagnant with discarded days. But time has flown the trap. If a body has left its bird-like impression, it's a fragile relic of preferences. So, changing one room for another should be a form of resurrection, or at least a probation of the will. On walls and shelves, the life chosen bears witness, like a cave dweller's daubs. You've no more chosen life than these dimensions. To finish off, and apologies if it's slightly on a down note, this one is called Epitaph. These are not days. They are shadows flitting over too familiar ground, dry and rubble-strewn, where our choices are buried. These are not days. These shades, tremulous, mere changes of light. Quiet as thieves, as witnesses, they slip past in silent legion. Count them up when they come to years. But years empty of substance, they're the dry husks of our lives, the whisper inside the hourglass. Days are not the coinage of will, as once we imagined. One day they rise, like locusts, to devour us.